Hi, my name is Linda, and I'm a survivor of sexual assault. In the summer of 1981, I was on top of the world. I had graduated from college a few years before and moved back to my hometown in Virginia. After sharing dorm rooms and apartments all through college, I was thrilled to have my very own apartment, which I had carefully decorated to suit my own taste. I had a great job, plenty of friends, and an active social life. That summer, the future seemed wide open and full of possibilities. Like most other August evenings, the day had been unbearably hot, and the night didn't bring much relief. My apartment had no air conditioning, so I kept all the windows open and used a large fan to circulate air in my bedroom. Even with the fan, it was too hot to sleep that night. So after watching a preseason football game on TV, I stayed up and watched a late movie. Finally, around 2 a.m., I made my way to bed. I was restless in the stifling heat, so it didn't surprise me too much when I woke up to find my clock radio unplugged. Thinking I had flung out an arm in my sleep and accidentally dislodged the plug, I plugged the clock in again and went back to sleep. Oddly, I woke a second time to an unplugged clock, fixed it, and rolled over. Then it happened again, and I began to feel uneasy. When I woke up a fourth time to see a man standing over my bed, I was overcome by terror. I tried to scream, but no sound emerged. The man put a cold metal object to my throat and told me not to make any noise. The fog of sleep quickly lifted, and I knew without a doubt that my life was in danger. The man put a pillow over my face and proceeded to rape me over the course of what seemed like hours. Because I couldn't see him, I strained to recognize the assailant by his voice, but he spoke very little, and my heart sank when I realized his voice was not familiar to me. At some point during the assault, I began to focus on doing whatever I could to get out of it alive. The rapist asked me a few questions, and I answered them calmly and truthfully. I didn't want to risk angering him enough to kill me. When he told me he was leaving and not to move for 10 minutes, I followed his instructions. But his warning turned out to be unnecessary, for I found my body just as paralyzed as my voice had been when he had first appeared in my room. When daylight arrived, I made myself get out of bed. Instinctively, I grabbed a steak knife from the kitchen, got in my car, and drove to the hospital. On the way, I passed a police officer sitting in his car in a grocery store parking lot. I told him what had happened, and he followed me to the emergency room. The experience of having evidence collected from my body at the hospital was not pleasant, but I was lucky to be treated by a young resident who was very gentle and compassionate. The doctor and nurse collected the evidence and handed it over to the police. Many years later, I would be glad I had gone through that difficult exam. The police combed my apartment for clues, but found little. In 1981, there was no such thing as DNA evidence, and no way to collect much more than hair samples and fingerprints. The forensic evidence yielded very little, just a blood type from the semen on the bedsheets, with no one to match it to, and a shoe print from where the rapist had hidden in my shower. The police asked me for the names of every man with whom I'd had contact in the past month. They interviewed all of them and even took shoes from each one of them, but nothing matched. The detectives took me to a police hypnotist, hoping that I had seen more than I remembered and that hypnosis would help me to recall more details, but that didn't work either. After a few months, the investigators called less and less often until we gradually lost contact and my case went cold. I call the next part of my life the in-between time. For 16 years, I lived in a very lonely place, feeling cut off from all that had made my life fulfilling in the past. At first, I was afraid to go out of the house, and when I did, I found myself looking at every man in the grocery store or across from me at a red light. Was he the one? Was it a colleague, a neighbor, someone who went to my church? Was he following me? Was he going to make good on his promise to come back and kill me because I'd gone to the police? For a long time, I found it hard to trust anyone but my family and closest friends. The life that had seemed full of possibilities was now suddenly reduced to two crucial priorities: feeling safe again and being able to function in a world that now felt hostile and dangerous. During the first year after the rape, a gifted counselor helped me to find the courage to venture back into the world, to enroll in graduate school, and to begin to set goals for my life. But when she suggested it was time to talk about the possibility of dating again, I decided our work together was finished. I felt certain my dating days were over. How could I ever be interested in a man when all men were suspect? As I began to function better outwardly, friends and family stopped asking questions about the rape and how I was coping. I'm sure it seemed that I was doing just fine, but inside, I felt isolated and alone. The rape became my constant companion, like a heavy pack that was invisible to others, but that was always there for me to carry. I think those who loved me were relieved to see me getting better, but I knew I wasn't getting better, just handling my pain differently. I knew it wasn't just going to go away. I managed to accomplish quite a lot during those in-between years. I finished graduate school and then taught at a nearby university for a couple of years. At age 30, I followed a call to ordain ministry and went to a seminary in South Carolina. Following graduation and ordination, I served as a parish pastor, a campus pastor, and a seminary development officer. Even though I knew that my experience as a rape survivor made me more compassionate towards others in crisis and made me a better pastor, I rarely spoke about the rape. I was living two different lives, outwardly competent and successful, inwardly broken and lonely. It would take a while, but soon those two lives would be brought together in a most amazing way. In July 1997, I was working as a development officer at a seminary in South Carolina. For no reason that I can explain, I picked up the phone one afternoon and called the police department of the town where I'd been raped. I couldn't remember the names of the detectives who had worked on my case, but I was hoping someone could give me some information that would allow me to gain a sense of closure on the rape. It felt like a long shot, and I was pretty sure no one would remember me. But about an hour later, I received a call back from Lieutenant Don Weaver, the investigator who had handled my case 16 years earlier. Not only did he remember me, but he had been trying to get in touch with me because he wanted to reopen my case and see what he could find out before he retired in a few years. I was stunned, elated, and scared. What if the case was reopened and we learned no more than we already knew? But I decided that this opportunity was a rare gift and that I had to pursue it as far as I could. The police found the original physical evidence from my case in their evidence room, where it had sat untouched for all those years. Inside the sealed cardboard box was the evidence from the hospital, along with about a dozen orphaned left sneakers. The linens from my bed were preserved inside a big garbage bag. Lieutenant Weaver brought the evidence to the state forensic lab in Richmond, where he requested a forensic scientist named Lisa Schiermeier to process the materials. So much had changed in forensic science since 1981. Now there was DNA analysis. I often joke that I was lucky to have been raped in Virginia, but when it comes to forensic science, it's true. Virginia's labs and scientists are among the best in the country. That doesn't mean the case went smoothly. Even though Schiermeier was the best person to handle the evidence, she had more than enough to do with her current caseload. Prompted by my never-ending phone calls, Lieutenant Weaver and Lisa made numerous requests until Lisa's boss finally gave her permission to do the DNA analysis. Although the evidence had been sealed for 16 years, it was somewhat degraded and fragile, and there wasn't very much of it. After using up almost all the evidence, Schiermeier decided to wait until the lab installed brand new state-of-the-art equipment before she ran some final tests. In the meantime, my life underwent many changes. The reopened case gave me the chance to talk with my family and friends again about the rape. We shared feelings we hadn't been able to share 16 years earlier, which was a wonderful healing experience. I told other people about what was happening and asked for their support. To my surprise, I got it. I had always feared that if I told people about the rape, they would be repulsed and turn away. Maybe some people did, but I didn't notice. What I found instead were others who had gone through experiences like mine and who had never talked about them either. And I encountered people who wanted to help, but just needed to be asked. In the fall of 1998, the bishop of my denomination in Virginia asked if I would become the interim pastor for a congregation whose pastor had just left because of sexual misconduct. Never one to turn down a challenge, I accepted. Once I was settled back in Virginia, I resumed my wait for forensic results. It took 2 years of touch-and-go forensic work, but finally, in 1999, Schiermeier solved the mystery. She had gathered enough DNA data to form a profile of the man who had raped me. When the evidence ruled out the police's primary suspect, Lisa decided to run the profile through Virginia's database of convicted felons and got what is known as a cold hit. The perpetrator turned out to be a convicted serial rapist who had been arrested 3 years after my rape and sentenced to several life sentences for raping three other women. I don't think I ever met him, though he lived just down the street from me when the rape occurred. I was ready to go all the way now, to push for prosecution and conviction of the rapist, so I could finally get the closure I'd sought for so many years. The police, the forensic people, and I were excited about the next step, but we were cut short by a prosecutor who refused to take the case, despite the DNA evidence and a confession. I have struggled for several years with the anger and disappointment this decision caused, but it does not diminish all that I've gained from my remarkable second chance. Because my case was so old, had been solved by DNA analysis, and involved a cold hit, it got a lot of media attention. I agreed to do interviews for a national magazine and some TV news programs. My case was unusual, and I knew I had a unique chance to use the voice I had once lost to raise public awareness of sexual assault and its survivors, maybe even to speak for someone who didn't yet have her voice back. The publicity pushed me to disclose my experience to the congregation I was serving. It was then that I understood the depth of their compassion and support. I'm still amazed that we were able to travel the same road to healing together. A congregation dealing with the aftermath of clergy sexual misconduct faces some of the same issues as survivors of sexual assault, including abuse of power, betrayal of trust, shame, and shattered faith. The first tentative step the congregation and I took together was to begin to speak openly about what had happened to us and to acknowledge our anger and our grief. That sharing was crucial in building our trust in one another and in God. My first public speaking opportunity came in 2001 when the bill calling for reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act was stalled in Congress. This important legislation provides funds for education and advocacy about sexual and domestic violence. I was invited to speak at a congressional press conference designed to influence legislators to pass the bill. Imagine my amazement when I rose to speak and turned around to see a dozen powerful lawmakers standing behind me. That day was a turning point for me. I discovered that the story I had kept locked inside for so long had a certain power. I decided not to keep silent any longer, but to tell my story to all who would listen. I have found healing in that process. For every time I tell my story, it loses a little bit of its hold on me. In addition, I hope that my sharing moves others to care about survivors of sexual assault. In a couple of years, my life will be divided right down the middle. 25 years before the rape and 25 years after. The two halves of my life are very different. Before the rape, I didn't know much about the evil that exists in our world, but then I met it face to face. Since then, I have learned that because I survived the rape, I can get through most of what life throws at me. I have discovered a passion for reaching out to others who have been touched by evil, especially survivors of sexual and domestic violence. In A Farewell to Arms, Ernest Hemingway wrote, "The world breaks everyone, and afterward many are strong at the broken places." I know that by the grace of God, those words are true for me. Not one of us leaves this life untouched. I believe we all can be agents of healing to help others find the strength that only comes from surviving brokenness. I still live with the burden of rape every day. Only now the pack isn't quite so heavy, and it isn't invisible anymore. I have some of the symptoms of post-traumatic stress syndrome and probably always will. I still struggle with dating relationships, but I was always pretty picky, and I found other single women my age who share the same struggle. I find myself now spending less time wondering what my life would have been like if I hadn't been raped, and more time looking forward with excitement to what lies ahead. I have been blessed with loved ones who have stuck with me through some very tough times, with law enforcement and forensic professionals who are my heroes, and with many opportunities for healing along the way. My life has followed many twists and turns, and at long last, I can honestly say again that life is good. I am now pursuing a career in jewelry design, something I couldn't even have imagined myself doing a few years ago. One of the wonderful insights I have received as a part of my healing is that I have a creative side that brings me much joy. I use all kinds of beads and stones in my work, but my favorite jewelry making material is beach glass. Beach glass begins as discarded broken jars and bottles. These jagged bits and pieces of glass wash out to sea and then end up on the beach amidst the shells and rocks. Years of being tumbled in the waves and blasted by sand and water turn sharp-edged bits of ordinary glass into treasures whose rough edges are worn completely smooth. It's easy to pass over beach glass, but when you kneel and sift through the sand and shells on the beach, you find it. Brown and green and white and blue, each a gem, each unique in size and shape. I was surprised to learn that it can take 15 or 20 years to completely smooth a piece of beach glass. That fact is kind of reassuring when I look back on how long God has been polishing me. Whenever I use a piece of beach glass in my jewelry, I'm reminded of Hemingway's words and my hope for all survivors, that they are made strong in the broken places, that their rough edges are smoothed, and that they find a beauty and purpose they may never have imagined for themselves.